in the reading of Romans has to do with tonight's lesson also. That's one of the reasons I picked the context, because it talks about the transientness of life, which is what Ecclesiastes is dealing with, and there's a reason for it. And in this, you know, hopefully we're looking for something better. And this is what the author of Ecclesiastes is trying to point us to. And so we'll get into that and start to cover that material. So we're in the book of Ecclesiastes. You can open your Bibles to it, or if you just want to follow with the context, specifically in the bulletin. We're in the second half of chapter 1. Introduction, we have discussed the conservative approach to understanding this work. We take it as done by God's inspiration and see it as a work of apt and marvelously skillful style with thoughts expressed with amazing exactitude. We have given an expanded definition to the term vanity, often is just termed empty, and we don't want to, that really makes this book a down book if you take vanity as being empty. Life is not empty, but it is transient. And that's the more expanded definition of the word, and that's what, you know, we're brought up in the context of Romans. Paul, a lot of this material, as we get into it, you'll see it's something that it makes its way into the New Testament. You're just often not aware of it, especially if you're using slightly different definitions. And we looked at what the author means by the life under the sun. And that is a life without God. And we're going to cover that again. The author now continues to explain what life is like without God in it. And so we left off at verse 9 last week. No rhyme or reason. It's just that I got to chop these things up somehow, you know, so we don't run too much over time. So part of the context is it's still flowing. We're talking about the sameness of things. As you look at life without God in it, a lot of times it doesn't look like it has any purpose. It just goes on and on and on. We had various examples of that. So now he goes, is there anything of which one may say, see this, it is new? Already it has existed for ages, which were before. So I'll give you some examples of this. But to the contrary, there are some things that you're going to find in life that are new with God in it. He's constantly been dealing with man, bringing in a newer and newer dispensation. And he talks about, you know, in Christianity, when you become a Christian, you become a new creature. You become something like, you know, hasn't been around for a long time. And constantly, you know, increasing in a different kind of kingdom. I mean, it was a physical kingdom. God's kingdom was under the Old Testament, although the spiritual aspect wasn't that apparent to many, but now it's made the transition into totally a spiritual nation. So there's, you know, things that are constantly being revealed by God, and all I can say too is if you think you've read the Bible and know it all, obviously you haven't studied in the original languages. Every day I get into it, I learn something new. You know, I've been around for a while, okay? There's just little annoyances, little things that come up all the time, you know, that are part of an infinitive universe of the Spirit that God's trying to reveal to us. And so look for the things new under God's creation, but if you're just looking for, you know, something without God in it, life gets very limited in almost closet form. So under the sun, the preacher asks, is there anything new? The answer is no. For it has always appeared long ago. I'll give you some examples. This seems to be a favorite word of the author as he comes back to it for ages and ages. Case in point, iron was discovered around the time of Tutankhamun. In fact, that's one of the, there's two daggers found in his tomb. One was of pretty much solid gold. The other was of something they find even more precious, iron. Because it's the first sample of that we have of iron. Although the Bible does mention iron as existing before the time of Noah. Just as goes, science today may help people live to be 120, but they used to live to be over 900. We still drive chariots with horsepower. And though we have gone to the moon, you know, so what? It's not even a greater journey than the people that left, you know, the European continent and came into a new world in small little ships. Can you imagine coming across the ocean in a boat smaller than this room? But they did it. Very adventurous. We do it for evolution or exploration, but without a godly purpose, man will still be the same and life will still be futile. And just as men have forgotten the earlier things, like how to build ships as big as an ark, so too he will forget how to build spaceships and computers and whatever else may come along. You know, a lot of the technology we're already losing. Notice how well the word and wisdom of God has been preserved, but not the words of the wisdom of men. God has promised his word will, you know, remain with us. If you look at any ancient book, contemporary, or just before the New Testament, the works of Homer, the Iliad and the Odyssey, we've only got, say, like 9 manuscripts of the Iliad, and they're incomplete. Whereas of the Bible, we have over 50,000 manuscripts and copies and everything else. No book of ancient time has been as well preserved as the Word of God. Okay? And the message hasn't changed either. God hasn't changed, and what's necessary for salvation, what's necessary in order to be in a right relationship, hasn't changed in over 10,000 years. Go back one. We got into 11. Okay, there's no remembrance of earlier things, also of later things which will occur. There will be no remembrance of those who will come later still. Does that bother you a little bit? You're probably, in, you know, 50 years after you're gone, nobody will know you even existed. Think of the massive amount of people that have lived on this planet and nobody even knows about them. Even the ones living now. You know, do you know one person? Yeah, I guess we do. But one person in all the billion of China or all the billion in India? All those people. You don't know a thing about them. They're going to pass away and there'll be no remembrance. Of man's wisdom, it is vanity of vanity, and history will change because man has a tendency to rewrite it. And this was the problem of the ancient world, where people had a tendency to write down history in a slant. You know, every ruler wanted to make himself look good. You'd be surprised how many battles were fought and both sides won. Why we look at Herodotus as the father of modern history is because he's the first one to kind of tell it like it is. Wasn't that the first one? God had a tendency to do that in the scriptures. Okay. And as men now work to change history, rewrite it, even for this country, it'll be lost. And then the problem will, you know, if you don't know your history, you're doomed to repeat it. Verse 12, I, the preacher, have been king over Israel and Jerusalem. The author now is going to explore the pursuit of earthly wisdom. This will take up to verse 18, since man is only too strongly moved to task himself in an independent search for truth apart from God. The writer wants to show where such a quest will lead. In John, John, at the end of his gospel, begins to say of the writing of books, there's no end. I mean, it's just, you know, if you go to Amazon or into a library even, you know, a small one, it's just, you know, book after book after book. You haven't got time to read them all. So which ones are important? Which ones are worth your time? The only one that's really worth our time at any time is the communication that our God has given us. And that's the scriptures. Nothing else is as important. Before you read any other book, you should know what it says. The writer for the moment places himself in the role of Solomon. We talked about that as our approach to this letter. To attempt what the king probably did, especially since so much of the wisdom literature is attributed to him. If this is after the exile, then his readers would naturally care to look to days of their former glory, which really wasn't that much of a former glory as we've been looking at in Samuel. The writer does not come out and say that he is Solomon, but using the title King over Israel in Jerusalem promotes the illusion. And then in verse 13, and I set my mind to seek and explore by wisdom concerning all that has been done under heaven. It is a grievous task which God has given to the sons of men to be afflicted with. In this role, the preacher says that he set his wisdom, that is, his heart or his mind, Hebrew commonly signifying mental faculties, to the searching or investigating of things. Since the context is centered on wisdom and knowledge, and their counterparts, madness and folly, he's going to both aspects of this, fully researching it. Also, the roots of the term search and explore suggest not an extensive gathering of information, but a careful analysis of existing data. So he's looking at what we've already got, the wisdom of Solomon and what's out in the world. That this does not include the wisdom from above is found in the expression under heaven. So we're just looking at what men has put out there. That's all he's looking at, and he's going to give us a conclusion of it. I have seen all the works which have been done under the sun, and behold, all is vanity and striving after wind. Why, he adds, it is a grievous task which God has given may mean that it is put in man's heart, like the need for worship. One anthropologist suggested that man seems to be, as he termed it, a worshiping animal. He has a need to worship something, whether it's himself or some creature or whatever. In just about every culture and civilization in all of history, people have to worship something. All of them have temples built of some god. It could be a pantheistic god. It could be a god of the woods, a Taoist look at things, or just a narcissistic look. But there's the need to look to something for help. It is something men eagerly set out to do, but without God's help as he intends, it becomes too complicated with disheartening results. Can you know everything? I mean, there's a lot of just garbage out there. And the problems we're running into, you get a lot of stuff on the internet that's just bogus. For some reason, people have have this inclination that they think it's cool just to put out misinformation. And so you get things Scopes or whatever it is that try to filter all this stuff out, but then it gets a little bit corrupted, and then you'll find another one that's more conservative or whatever. But it's, you're going to run into the problem. In fact, they kind of try to do it with the scriptures too, and that's our problem. Men try to corrupt things to even get away from the Word of God. He explains that all efforts to gain wisdom under the sun is like striving after the wind. I mean, how can you sit there and just get a handle on everything that's out there, especially since it's moving so quickly and changing so much? Or our modern proverb would be, the more you know, the more you realize, the less you know. Yeah. When I got to that, it's like they were so thrilled when they built, big cyclotron, atom smasher, where they thought, oh, now we're going to be able to, break down the atom and all of its component parts. We'll discover the secrets of the universe. And after they'd been working on it for a while, they asked the director of it, Fermi, he said, do we know any more than we did? And he goes, no, now we just got more questions. And that's the problem, of life under the sun. What is crooked cannot be straightened. What is lacking cannot be counted. This makes it even worse. Here the preacher is following up with other truths that make the same point. One soon finds that the fortresses of ignorance that men have erected cannot be undone. Stop and think about it. Just in the religious world. Okay, the Bible talks about the corruption that's going to come, the falling away, the apostasy, whatever you want to talk about it. And you begin a building up of what is to develop into the Catholic Church. And it gets so man-powered that after a while, its own priests begin to look at the scriptures and allowed to look at it, although that's not what God intended. And their priests are going, wait a minute, what we're doing is not what's in the scriptures. Okay? And so they started about 400, 450 years ago, what they call a Reformation movement. Going to reform the Catholic Church. Well, anything that's been around that long cannot be changed. You can't turn it around. It's like trying to turn around a giant ship. You know, if you got one of these big battleships at sea and it's under full, you know, steam, and you decide, yeah, I gotta go a different direction or head back. It takes like 26 miles or something like that to stop this thing and turn it around. And a lot of these things, these fortresses that men build, and they are like monuments to really their ignorance, although they think it's their knowledge. I mean, you can't, you know, with a lot of these religions that are out there, it's hard to change them, you know, turn them around, you know, convince them that they're wrong. You get into the secular world, you know, how much is, you know, evolution taken off? I mean, you cannot convince these scientists that what they're thinking about is totally against all their scientific principles. I'll give you one instance, you know, which I think is like the most probably damaging, is that in a, I took a statistics course in college. You know, one thing I'll tell you, there's not a statistician that believes in evolution. I mean, it's in their book. Basically, because, you know, and the one example one guy gave is, you know, you take Carl Sagan, and he says the odds of evolution occurring is 1 in 10 to 250th. But the statistician tells you that anything that's larger than 1 in 10 to the 50th is an impossibility. So the statisticians will tell you evolution is impossible by the numbers they have to run. But it doesn't faze anybody. You can't turn this behemoth around. And a lot of times what you have to do is just wipe the table clean and start all over again. That's what we had to do in religion. You know, start a restoration movement. Forget everything you know about what men taught about religion and go back to what God taught in the first century. Okay? You can't make what's crooked straight, but you can start all over again with the right stuff. Okay? This was true of the world in the time of Noah, and it needed God to wipe out everything and start all over again. You know, men had gone off too far. Their hearts had become too wicked. Thus, what men have bent cannot be straightened, and no human wisdom agency could supply all the pieces that have been lost. When man fell, he lost all the knowledge of, you know, it was in the tree of knowledge. And other things that God was trying to teach us. It's only been preserved in the scriptures. 16. I said to myself, behold, I have magnified and increased wisdom more than all who are over Jerusalem before me, and my mind has observed a wealth of wisdom and knowledge. I mean, this, he's putting on his credentials. He's done this more than anybody else at this time has ever even tried to accomplish. Okay? So the next two verses are the preacher's summary of all this work that he's done. And he's going to expand this in the next couple of chapters. So as he gets into it, he begins by saying he did succeed in becoming more accomplished with his task than all in Jerusalem. He had managed to accumulate a wealth of wisdom and knowledge that has given him a decided advantage. Yeah, and he says, I set my mind to know wisdom and to know madness and folly, and I realized this was also striving after wind. Further, to balance his judgment, he also set his mind to know, you know, the opposite side of all this. He added thoroughness to his noble experiment. If we carry our supposition further, we might suggest that Solomon actually carried out all this, and this guy's just, you know, decided to write it all down for us. You know, what was Solomon's conclusion before he, you know, broke off and it took him in the wrong direction? Yet this too is striving after the wind. Because in much wisdom there is much grief, and increasing knowledge results in increasing pain. It was not so much that the search for wisdom and knowledge did not yield much, but rather what it yielded, you know, was both painful and grief-ridden. Again, see if we, this helps explain what the preacher means by remembering the Creator before the evil days come. And the older you get, the more you understand how things work, the more you realize just how bad things are, how corrupt they are, how much evil there is in the world. Growing up, well, we have all this hope and, you know, whatever, but we really don't understand how governments work, how people think about things, what they're really trying to accomplish, all the lies that are out there that we think are good and, you know, for us, but there's a different agenda behind it all. This is the evil that's in the world. And so instead of from going, you know, sunny for the rest of our days, the world starts to get bitter and dark and dim, especially if you don't have the hope of God in it. God can keep it brighter. You know, it gives you hope. You know, he is the one that can change things and turn them around. I mean, you need to understand history in order to understand just how bad it was in Europe before this country got started. Okay. 11 of the 13 colonies were started with religious charters. Individuals coming from Europe here because of religious persecution. They wanted to come here to study on their own. It was the first time that they were really allowed to study the scriptures for themselves openly, without having to hide in the hedgerows, you know, of Ireland, or being pursued, you know, as Wycliffe and Tyndale were all across Europe, or even trying to make an English translation. I mean, it was really, you know, there's a reason they call it the Dark Ages. But God provided something here, and as they were allowed to begin to study their Bible openly, they started to see that, yeah, we can go back to the original and be perfectly happy with God. You know, he gave man a new start here. Unfortunately, it's beginning to dim. But it doesn't mean that he can't do it again and again and again. Okay? It was darker than this during the time of Noah. It's been darker than this in Europe in the first century. God can turn things around if we do our part. The older one gets and naturally observes more of how things work under the sun, the more corrupt it looks. And then our summary. Instead of going back over this stuff again. We'll part with this little bit. Something I ran across this week. Bertrand Russell, a 20th century atheistic philosopher, claimed that no one could sit by the bedside of a child with a terminal disease and believe in a loving God. Think about that. That's a lot of times the atheist's biggest argument. Of all the things that go on, in fact, this is something that was referring to what just happened in Haiti. You know, could a loving God look at all this tragedy and all this kind of stuff and let it happen? We've taken you along this thinking before, but you know, we have a few visitors. We'll stop and think about it. If, because you know there are children that are suffering, because there are people that undergo you know, natural catastrophes and all this, let's just say, okay, that's a proof that there is no God. Okay, now that we've gotten God out of the equation, who is responsible? Mother Earth? You know, whatever deities you know people want to look at, what you know atheism. What caused it? Big argument. What you know, caused you know the problem in Haiti and what just occurred also in China is the fact of the corruption of men because of the kickbacks, because of you know the really payback under the table. Corruption kind of stuff that goes on in these societies where, you know, building codes are not followed. You know, the houses are not erected to withstand earthquakes. So all this stuff happens, whose fault is it? You know, if you decided to build your house across the San Andreas Fault and suddenly it goes off, whose fault is that? Here's his point, though. Bertrand Russell felt unable to reconcile the situation of a terminally ill child with belief in a loving God. A minister who had experience with dying children challenged this unbeliever to explain what he himself could offer such a child. An atheist could only say something like, "Sorry, but that's how it goes. This is the end of everything for you. Not only is your life, you know, bad, there's nothing for you afterwards." That's the only, you know, if you can call it hope, that an atheist can give anybody. Contrast this hopeless declaration with such promises as in John 3:16, "For God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten Son, that whoever believes in him should not perish but have everlasting life." It doesn't matter how bad it is in this life. If you are committed to following God, to trusting him, he can not only get you through all the pain and the agony and the suffering in this life, he can make it better in this life, and he can eliminate all of it and give you a lot better life in the one to come. A body that doesn't have the illness and disease, gifts beyond measure, a life in his presence where there's nothing but joy. What atheist can give you that? In fact, a lot of atheists find they have to terminate their own life because they find it too sad and too dark. Life under the sun, where there's always hope with God. This is why the Ecclesiastes writer gets in the transientness of stuff. Yeah, we're only here for a short time. James says it's a vapor. But what are you going to do with yourself in that time? God wants you to start turning to him. In fact, that's one of the reasons why he leaves a lot of this problems here. It's almost like rubbing our nose in it. We've mentioned this before. God gave us Eden. This is what we started with, a perfect life. And we decided we wanted something else. And we walk out of the garden. God tried again with the Israelites. He led them out of captivity of the most mightiest nation on earth, rescued them from being slaves, parted the seas for them to cross, made sure their enemies didn't attack them, made sure their clothes didn't wear out, made sure that they were fed every day. And when they got to the promised land, they were going to get cities they didn't build, vineyards they didn't plant, cisterns they didn't dig, and they still didn't want it. Things are bad, don't blame God. He's tried twice before. In fact, he's tried a third time. He sent his son to die for us, to make life very special in service to him. What he says, there's no man that has left father, mother, sister, brother, farm for my sake and the gospel's sake that will not receive 100 times more in this life, in the world to come, life without end. Blessings beyond counting, joy beyond measure. That's the invitation. If you don't like how things are going, you can change it. Come to God. The invitation's always extended. Won't you come as we stand to sing?